Thank you, Tom. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Way of Truth. My name is Kenny Chumley. I'm the preacher for the Gibson City Church of Christ, and today we continue our study in talking about the truth of Christianity. Before we get to that, I'm going to take a couple of minutes here to tell you about the Church of Christ in Gibson. We're a group of people who are trying to be followers of Jesus, and we meet every Sunday at our building on the south side of town. We're the first building north of what used to be the Pizza Hut, catty corner from the drive-in theater. And we're going to meet at 9 o'clock, and we begin our worship with Bible classes for all ages. In the adult class this morning, we will be in Luke chapter 14, talking about an event in the life of Christ. At 10 o'clock, our worship will involve congregational singing and praying, eating the Lord's Supper, scripture being read, and preaching from the Bible. This morning's topic is God the Father. I'm going to do a sermon on God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, and we'll start this morning with God the Father. At the conclusion of the sermon, we take a short break, and then we have a second Bible study that lasts 20 to 30 minutes. In this second study, we're in the book of Leviticus, and we'll be talking about some of the sacrifices that were part of the Mosaic system this morning. This coming Wednesday, we have a midweek study, 7 o'clock, lasts for an hour, and because this is the last Sunday of the month, we've designated this time to be spent worshiping God in song, and we invite you to come and join us in that, and to remember that we have a website, GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com. And on that website are audio files of these lessons from the radio, audio files of the sermons, our church bulletin, correspondence courses you can take, and other information about what we believe. And that again is GibsonCityChurchOfChrist.com. Well, I've been talking about the truth of Christianity, and the point that I began making last week is that the written word is a reliable means of communicating actual, real events. The written word is a way to preserve history and the way to transmit to coming generations what happened during our time. And we accept that premise in virtually every way possible. If we're going to research our ancestry, go on ancestry.com, we're going to be relying upon written documents, circuit court records of births and deaths, deeds of property, diaries that have been left. We establish our genealogy on the basis of written records. We establish our knowledge of the ancient world, of the founding of America, on the discovery of new lands by explorers on the basis of written documents. We don't have any videotape of James Cook sailing into the Hawaiian Islands. We only have written documents of that. And the same is true with regard to Christianity. God chose to communicate the facts, the truth about the founding of Christianity via written records. Now, is it possible for men to misinterpret historical documents? Well, of course it is. Do men sometimes misuse historical records? Of course they do. Does that mean that history cannot be accurately transmitted or understood? Well, of course not. You see, we have devised means, people who have spent time looking into this and studying this, have devised tests, they have devised means by which fraud can be detected, by which we can get to the truth of something that happened in the past with a very high degree of probability. And let me take just a minute here to say something about the level of certainty that we're talking about. Back in the earlier part of the 20th century, there were a group of philosophers in Vienna. They became known as the Vienna Circle. And in their discussions, they really made a valuable contribution to how we understand, to how we acquire knowledge. They pointed out, for instance, that propositions fall into one of three categories. Now, a proposition is an assertion. A proposition is a claim that something is true. And the Vienna Circle noted that there are three types of propositions that can be made, spoken or written. The first type they called analytical propositions. These are statements that are logically or definitionally true. If I said that red is red, well, of course it is. If red was green, it wouldn't be red, it would be green. 2 + 2 = 4. All wives are women are examples of analytical statements that are true on the surface. They are definitionally, logically true. A second type of proposition they called synthetic propositions, empirical propositions, propositions that are demonstrated to on the basis of empirical investigation. An example of such a proposition would be water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, that statement's not definitionally true. You have to watch water get colder. You have to conduct a test. You have to see at what temperature water freezes, and on the basis of our senses. And that's what the word empirical refers to. Empirical is knowledge acquired via our senses of sight, smell, taste, touch, hearing. On the basis of our senses, we know that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. We know that Lincoln was killed in Ford's Theater on the basis of empirical historical evidence. And then the third type of proposition is called nonsensical. And it's not called nonsensical because it's nonsense. The third type of proposition is called nonsensical because you cannot prove it's true either analytically or synthetically. Here's an example. 1,000 angels can stand on the head of a pin. Now, that may be true, but how would we ever prove it? There's no way we can prove it. And so we have these three different types of statements called analytical, synthetic, and nonsensical. Now, here's what's important. Here's why I mentioned these. Analytical statements are certain. They carry 100% certainty. It is 100% certain that red is red, or that 2 + 2 = 4. Synthetic statements only carry probability. And nonsensical statements only state possibility. Now, in regard to history, we're never going to know with 100% certainty whether Caesar crossed the Rubicon, or whether Alexander conquered Persia, or whether the Greeks defeated the Persians at Salamis. We're never going to know those things with 100% certainty. When you go to the doctor and he tells you to stick out your tongue and he looks inside and says, you know, you've got strep throat. He doesn't know that with 100% certainty. But the probability is extremely high that he's correct. If you're ever called to sit on a jury and evidence is provided and then you go into the jury room and you reach a verdict, that verdict is never based on 100% certainty. People have been convicted wrongly. Evidence, verdicts, are rendered on the basis of probability. So when I talk about the truth of Christianity, when I talk about the New Testament being reliable, I don't mean by that we have 100% certainty. What I mean by that is we have a high degree of probability. And even further, the New Testament has the highest degree of probability of any document from antiquity. There is greater historical certainty for the reliability of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John than there is for any other document from antiquity. And I've been talking about reasons why we know that is. Last week, for instance, I pointed out that the New Testament documents contain early testimony to the life of Christ. You know, the longer after an event, before we write it down, you know, if something happens and we want to remember it, and we're going to write down what happens, the longer the gap between the event and our writing down, the less accurate we tend to be. Now, the New Testament was written within about 25 years of the life of Christ, and I talked about how we know that to be so. Homer, the great Greek poet, Plato, the Greek philosopher, Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote hundreds of years, in some cases, about events after events they talked about occurred. But the New Testament, 25 to maybe 50 years after the life of Christ, the New Testament was written down. One of the things I do through the week is permissions research. I do permissions research for the University of California Press, for professors at Harvard, for professors at Princeton, Columbia University, and elsewhere. I'm currently doing a permissions research job for a Princeton professor who is an historian. And the book that I'm working on talks about events that happened 75 years ago during World War II in Nazi Germany. And in this book, he cites documents that were written about that time, and he talks about the result of discussions he had with eyewitnesses back in the 70s. He had two face-to-face meetings with Albert Speer, who was one of Hitler's top aides, and he's told me about these meetings. He talks about them in his book. And so here's this book that's coming out, and anyone who's interested in the subject and buys it and reads it, no one's going to think that it's unreliable simply because it's written 75 years after World War II, after the events that it talks about, because within the book there is evidence that what my friend, the professor, is writing about is based on solid historical testimony. And that's what we have with the New Testament. All of the tests, all of the criteria that men use to determine the reliability of a book, the New Testament comes in at the head of the class. It ranks the highest of any book from antiquity. Did you know, for instance, that within 150 years after the life of Christ, he is mentioned by 43 authors, nine of whom were either eyewitnesses or contemporaries of him. Within 150 years of the life of Christ, 43 authors. You know how many authors mention Tiberius Caesar, who was the Caesar at the time Christ began his public ministry, within 150 years of the life of Tiberius? Only 10. 43 for Jesus, 10 for Tiberius. And among these authors for Jesus, we do have eyewitnesses. Peter said, we did not follow cleverly invented stories about Jesus. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty. In Acts 2:32, Peter says that God raised up Jesus, and we all, speaking of the apostles, are witnesses of the fact. In Acts 3:15, Peter says that God raised Jesus from the dead, and we are witnesses of this. And in Acts 4, verses 18 and 20, Peter says, we can't stop speaking about what we have seen and heard. And not only that, but Luke in the book of Hebrews claimed to be based on eyewitness testimony. And so Peter, Paul, and John all claim to be eyewitnesses. And we could throw Matthew into that account too, because Matthew was an apostle. Luke and Hebrews claim to be informed by eyewitnesses. Paul specifically mentions 14 people, and then generally mentions 500 others who were witnesses of Jesus. The evidence is overwhelming for the life of Christ and for the reliability of the New Testament. And so next week, we'll go just a little bit farther into this. I'm trying to provide a foundation, a logical basis for people to believe in the credibility and the accuracy and the truthfulness of the book that tells us about Jesus Christ. Thank you for listening. I hope you got through Thanksgiving in good shape, and I hope you have a good week ahead of you. And I'll look forward to being with you again next Sunday at 8 o'clock right here on The Way of Truth.